Hello, and welcome to episode 40 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Shuffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by a man who really needs no introduction on this podcast, Stephen Hurley. Stephen is a creator of Voice Ed Radio, a retired teacher, and a generally awesome guy. He has conversations about education all day, every day through a Voice Ed, and is still passionate about it, which truly amazes me. Stephen and I talk about his love of radio, the power of voice, the problem of looking for problems, trust people have in education, listening to other voices that don't agree with you, and Stephen just tells some wonderful stories. So it's a really good listen. So sit back and enjoy episode 40 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Stephen Hurley. All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Shuffler. I am joined today by a man who, when I explained to my fiance tonight who I was going to be interviewing, she said, "Haven't you interviewed him already?" And I said, "Yeah, you would think so, right?" But the first time I asked, he said he was too busy. And so I didn't ask again because he hurt my feelings. But I'm really excited. All joking aside, I'm tremendously excited to be joined today by the wonderful Stephen Hurley, who I talk about all the time on my podcast because of all the amazing work he does at Voice Ed Radio. But what's going on, Stephen? How are you doing tonight?
Well, you know, it's great to be here. And I'd just like to jump in and say, in defense of, I would never say, I can't imagine saying I'm too busy. I may have said it facetiously, thinking that it was just the funniest thing to be said that day, and obviously it was not taken that way. So
it was probably said on, if I remember right, it was said in chat on. I remember what happened. You and I and Sarah were still on a Zencaster hangout after an On Ed Mentors episode, and the three of us were talking, and I talked about how Sarah's episode was coming out, and you made a joke about how you hadn't even been invited. And I was like, "Well, of course I'm going to invite you, Stephen. I just haven't gotten to it yet," or whatever. And like, while we're sitting there and you're like, "Well, I guess I'm just not invited, blah, blah, blah," I sent you a DM while we're all in the chat and said, "Hey, Stephen, do you want to be a guest on my show?" And your reply was, "We're just too busy."
So, but that's right. That is something I would have said, expecting yes. You to push back, but you didn't. So there you go. So I apologize.
To be fair, I have pushed back regularly for the last 6 months.
I'm upstairs a few moments ago with my son, and he said, "Do you have a broadcast tonight?" Because usually I do. And I said, "Yeah, I have a conversation." He says, "It's with who?" And I said, "It's Brad Shuffler." "Oh, is he interviewing you?" And I said, "Yes, he is." He says, "Well, that's a first." not that you're interviewing me, that is a first. It's the fact that not many people interview me. I think I've been on some podcasts, of course, and it sounds like I've been on every podcast, but I'm not one of those people that are all over the podcast world as a guest, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of the voice and the voice of God on Voice Ed Radio at all times. I feel like you're just at any point, Stephen can come in and be, "You have been smited." And like, except I don't feel like you created the world of Voice Ed, but you're really just like, if you were the God, you'd be the God of words, the God of etymology. Like that would be your forte, I think.
Oh man, that would be heaven. Nirvana, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, we could talk in metaphors all night, but no, I do love words. I love the whole medium of radio because I love words, and it's nice to be able to spend my day talking to people, which is what I do.
Yeah. Well, can you tell me a little, for my podcast guests who aren't necessarily Voice Ed listeners all the time, can you tell me a little bit about you, how you ended up in the space you're in, a little bit about your history?
Oh, man. I had my radio career mapped out when I was in grade 4. And I went to a Catholic school, and Sister Leona, this was the 60s, and we had, in Ontario, they had just come out with a new document. Actually, they're celebrating the 50th anniversary this year of the Hall-Dennis Report. came out, and it was all about more personalized learning, more student-centered learning, active, meaningful, relevant. It's a lot of what we hear today. But anyway, as it turns out, in grade four, we had this open concept classroom, because that's what the Hall Dennis Report is most known for, is breaking down the wall. I remember, Brad, I remember being handed a microphone, a record player, and a tape, cassette tape deck. And there was one record that we had in our classroom collection, and it was the story of Batman and Robin. And I remember going off into the corner for, I say, 2 weeks. It's probably more like 1 week, and being allowed just to experiment with sound and pretend that I was a broadcaster. And I went home during that time, and I imagined that my bedroom was my TV studio and my radio studio, because I knew at that time I had a face for radio. But I just created these productions, and that went on into grade seven and grade eight. And I remember there was a novelty record out in 1971 or 72, and I can't remember the name. I will remember the name. And it was called Mr. Jaws. And what the guy did, and I believe his name was Goodman. Anyway, what he did was he created this story, and there was a bunch of dialogue in the story, except it wasn't spoken word dialogue. He inserted excerpts from songs. So it was amazing. You have to hear it. But it was an amazing just back and forth. He'd ask a question, and he would put on, a little snippet of a song that would answer it. So I was taken by that. I was just taken by that. Dickie Goodman. That's what I did. Radio Shack was my, cathedral. And I was the first one in line every Saturday. Actually, I was the only one in line every Saturday. Nobody went to Radio Shack. But I was there.
Interestingly, still having that problem today. Still no one goes to Radio
Exactly. They just closed a few down. But I bought, tape splicers and cassette decks. And, so that was my life. That was my life. When I was in high school, I wanted to go to radio college. I got to grade 12. And I wanted to apply to Ryerson Polytechnic Institute, it was at the time. And my parents wouldn't even let me go and pick up the application, because it was a polytechnic institute. It wasn't a university. They forced me to go to grade 13, which we had in Ontario at the time. And I went and studied philosophy and then theology. But you know what? They say that passion never dies. So that's a long story to tell you that 50 years later now, I am starting my radio career. It's so that, coupled with the fact that I have spent the past 35 years in public education, and I have really been taken by the power of conversation and the power of good, deep conversation. The conversations that you have after everyone else leaves the pub on Friday after work, everyone else has gone home, and there are a few people just hanging around talking about the week. And I said, that's what I want to do. So that combination of the love of good education discourse and radio is what ended up being Voice Ed Radio, and that's what we've been nurturing here for the past year.
Yeah, and I think that's where your vision and Voice Ed Radio meld so well with what I do, because that's very similar to my own experience of recognizing that those conversations, those unplanned interactions, that moment where things just sort of connect because all the pieces in the universe have led to these two or three people being in a room at this time. And all of a sudden you're having conversations that are changing the way you look at education and actually building you professionally and developing you. And I felt like they were so powerful. And that's what I appreciate so much about Voice Ed, is that it is a constant space where things are happening. People are having conversations. The discussion is moving forward. And it's just it's such a powerful place. And you mentioned that you had an anniversary. That was, by the time this airs, that'll have been last month. Just the beginning of last month was the anniversary of Voice Ed Radio, which is, 1 year in, and what a journey it has been in that year.
It's been amazing. And, there have been a couple, and when Sarah was asking in her podcast, about that, one of the highlights of the past year for me, in addition to meeting everyone that's now part of this community, is interviewing two of the people that for the past decade I have sparred with on blog sites out there that really were the inspiration behind trying to bring some of these polarized conversations into one place. And so to have those two voices here and realizing that, hey, we've never met before. We got a chance to meet face to face finally in the fall of this year at a conference. And I invited them on and they came, and we realized that there's something about hearing someone's voice. You know, you can write comments on blog entries till the cows come home, and you can, you know, take your position and keep your position and hold your position really tightly. But as soon as you hear someone speak, something happens, and it's more than magic. It's human interaction. And so much of the polarization that comes in this space that is naturally here because of the political nature of public education, especially, it doesn't melt away, but I think we make progress when we allow people to hear each other's voice.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that ties your story together so well of, like, you know, Canadian Batman and Robin, who I'm, you know, guessing are just a lot more polite than my Batman and Robin. And that led you to all the way to taking that love of voice and bringing it into the education space. And I think that intersect is something you're really building in a really powerful way. And you won't admit that. I think you typically are very humble about it. And I appreciate that. But at the same time, you made this whole thing possible. You made, you know, you helped push Sarah to start her podcast. You've given Derek a space to toy with and do ridiculous things like make me eat hot sauce on a Wednesday night. Like, you've made all those things possible to where all of us go, yeah, let's try something. And even when I came on with the assumption of, like, okay, well, yeah, you can air my podcast stuff. And really quickly, I fell in love with the live space of what this is. And in a lot of ways, Voice Ed has really impacted my own show because I've gotten to where I do a lot less editing. First of all, doing more time live on Voice Ed, I'm better at doing these interviews without needing to do as much editing. But also, I'm okay with the imperfection because I've gotten so used to doing it and just, you know, going with things as they roll, and we move on, you know, and I think that is really the power of Voice Ed Radio.
Well, you know, Brad, I think there's a vulnerability that comes with going live. And when I reach out to potential guests and I have this calendar, time trade calendar, as you know, and I just send people the link there's only been one person in the world that has said, no, I'm not interested, three times, by the way. Usually they'll say, you know, it'll have to be next month, but they'll book a time. And I'll reach out to them and I'll say, are you okay to go live? And they say, well, I don't know, you know, that's live. And I said, well, we could record it, but it would be just like live. I'm not doing a whole lot of editing. And that comes from someone who back in 2010 started a podcast series with the Canadian Education Association. And I would talk to people on Skype, record it, and we talked for about an hour, but I knew I had the podcast had to be 20 minutes. And I don't know why I talked for an hour, but I spent hours and hours, hours editing out ums and breaths to make it sound like your equivalent of NPR, you know, and I realized in this space, that's not real. That's not real. I shouldn't have to, and I shouldn't be able to shift comments around so that they sound good. I shouldn't be re-recording my questions so that I sound polished. So there's a vulnerability that comes when you go live, and I really, really like that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I do minimal editing on my own show, but I didn't at the beginning. At the beginning, I thought I needed to eliminate all the ums and take out all the heavy breathing and now I just don't, because it takes so much time. And when I did it, I felt like going back and listening to it, it didn't feel natural. It didn't feel real. And that wasn't what I was going for. I wasn't looking to be this polished NPR show. I didn't need that in my space. That's not what we need as educators, I don't feel like.
No. And there's an authenticity there. And I can remember a couple of people writing me an email after hearing one of those Canadian Education Association podcasts that they were guests on. And they said, man, you made me sound really good. I didn't even recognize myself. And I thought, okay, well, that's not good. They may be happy with that, but that's not good. So this space is, and I love the fact that, you know, that people will come on and do live, and we're really feeling a lot more comfortable with each other. And, you know, the Sunday night show I do with Derek, Carol Salva joined in on Sunday, and, you know, feels comfortable. It's nice. It feels like family. No, it doesn't feel like family. I don't talk this well with my family.
It feels like my voice ed family. I do love it. I mean, it does in a lot of ways feel there's a closeness there that goes beyond a professional learning network, and, you know, to even something different than a friendship. There's something about it, because we do spend so much time between Twitter and voice ed and on ed mentors and Derek's Sunday night show and all the other live stuff going on. We do seem to spend all this time together, it feels like. And it is a personal connection that goes beyond. And a lot of that has to do with voice. And I think you're right. But, you know, we've been talking for 15 minutes already, and we've barely touched on education on my education podcast. So we should, you know, we should maybe think about it. And we did. We talked about things that are important as well. But I want to get to my first question, because I have a feeling a lot of these same themes will make their way into the discussion as we move forward. And my first question, as you know, is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
I think the biggest problem facing education today is the fact that we're going around looking for problems. I know that sounds like a smart aleck remark, but I believe that we... And I'm not the inventor of this theory. I take a lot of my inspiration from David Cooperreiter and the folks, Martin Seligman, on positive psychology. I think we're going to find what we go looking for. And I think the metrics that we use, which are really just proxies now for success and for success of our students and success of our systems, are the wrong ones. And they lead us to think that there's problems where there are none, and they lead us to ignore the real challenges in this space. And so I think they take us off our game. So I think that problem seeking, it's like a heat seeking missile. As soon as test scores come out, we quickly point to the problem. And I think that's the problem. We don't take a close enough look at the fact that education and the spaces where schools live and breathe are complex environments. They're not as complicated as they are complex. And when you deal with complexity, you have to be willing to take the deep dive. And we're not willing, by and large, we're not willing to do that as systems. I was reading a tweet by John Hattie today, and he was pushing a keynote that he's doing next month, or I think it's next month. And he was saying something along the lines of, we have to stop asking what works in education. That's the wrong question. He says, because anything can work. If you have a pulse, you can make it work. He says, the real question is, what works best? And I would push against that one and say, that's still not the right question. In complex environments, we have to ask, what works best for this student at this time, on this day, in this environment? And that sounds ridiculous, because it's not scalable. It's not a scalable, it's not a scientific way of looking at it, but it is completely humanistic. And, so that's a long way to say that I think the problem, the biggest problem facing education today, is that we're looking at problems that are not really problems, and we're ignoring the ones that do exist. And there are a lot of those. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You touched on something in particular. So what you hit on that it really spoke to me there is is as soon as we see the test scores, we immediately start to look for the problem and we point fingers. And I think that's a critical point there is, I don't know that I agree we shouldn't be looking for problems. Obviously, that's the first question on my podcast. I kind of think it's important. But I get your point, which is, I feel like it's a different search than what I'm doing. You know, I there's one search, which is, okay, the test scores aren't what we want them to be. What is the problem? Versus what are the problems we are facing as educators? And I think there's a different search there. And I can agree with you wholeheartedly on that test score factor. You know, as someone who's in the past been able to use test scores to show that I know what I'm doing and I can do great gains with my students or whatever, I still couldn't always point and tell you why my gains were as high as they were or why my students performed better than another teacher or whatever. Like, I don't really know every single reason they perform well. I just did what I needed to, I knew I needed to do in my classroom. And I can agree with you that you shouldn't immediately take that data and point to a problem with it. And I think at the same time, and along that same line, we don't constantly need the data to be the drive to find the problem so that we can fix the problems. And so we can start to look at the amount of data we're collecting. And is that really necessary too? So I think, yeah, it makes total sense to me that, you know, at the end of the day, we need to find what's best for each individual student. And the data isn't going to tell us that. The data is giving us some sort of aggregate belief that we can have a, you know, measurable effect on our sample size or whatever statistical measure they go with.
Yeah, it just sends us down the wrong path. And you know, I'm having conversations on Monday nights with Jillian Judson and the Imaginative Education Research Group out of Simon Fraser University. And she's talking a lot about, well, imaginative education is based on the idea that emotional connection to what we're learning is not only necessary, it's the core of every learning experience, that emotional connection. We can't get emotionally connected to aggregated data. And it hides, I think it hides so much. In addition, I think, you know, from an economic standpoint, a lot of that data is, they're trailing indicators. They're things that, you know, it's like watching the car go by and say, oh, the car just went by. Well, there's nothing you can do about it. I think we need to start focusing on what those leading indicators, what the, you know, the symptoms of success, are, you know, in terms of our learning environments and what our schools look like and what they feel like. And, it's complex. And there's a whole politic around those scores as well. And, you know, how they get picked up by the media, how they get picked up by, various think tanks and presented out to the public. And one of the, can I add something to that? Biggest problem thing.
This is your hour. This is where you get to speak.
I think in Canada, and I don't know that it's the same in the States, but we have lost a very important, I'm going to say ally. I'm not sure whether they were ever allies, but our media here, we've lost that sense of, journalism around education. We've adopted a reporting, stance that reports only the bad things that are happening. And what that does is it skews the whole sense of, narrative. It, reduces the amount of trust, that we have in our institutions, not only our education institutions, but societal institutions in general. And it reduces the amount of trust that parents have for individual, schools and administrators and teachers. And I think it's, we need to get back to those, long form, looks at education, almost a documentary type of approach, to what's happening in schools. And we don't have that. And I think that's a loss. And that's,
I can tell you for sure, we definitely have the same problem in the States. I feel like we often have an interesting dichotomy though, because we have, our local news is more than willing to cover a great teacher or a great student or one great program or idea that's coming out there, but then they are glad to bash the district or the state or the federal, or every single thing that's wrong is something wrong with the school on the whole, not the individuals within it. There's like this weird double standard almost. But I agree. We 100% have the problem that the media is rarely on our side in education, and that it does, it erodes the public trust. You know, that whole concept of like those who do and those who can't teach, you know, and that's that social belief in a lot of cases. And part of that is perpetuated by the fact that almost always stories that are out there are negative about education. So yeah, I think it's a real problem.
You know, it's, but you know, we talk about the media as if it's this, this animal unto itself. I have conversations with journalists. I reach out to them and, actually invite them on to Voice Ed Radio, and, they have to check with their superiors, you know, and, but I want to go through the national scene and invite those local beat reporters on who have education, in their portfolio. When I talk to them, they're very nice and they're very supportive. And, but when push comes to shove, they have to report on things that are going to sell. And, you know, we're living in such an interesting time, in terms of media and what people will read. You know, that clickbait is there. If, you know, I even know that if there's a story about a teacher and misconduct on the front page of my newspaper, that's the first story I'm going to click on. Well, I wonder if I know this person, you know, or wonder if that, you know, I think so. If I were teaching now, if I was beginning my teaching career now and did some of the things and reacted some of the ways to students, that I did in those first years of teaching where I didn't know anything, I would have been brought in front of our College of Teachers for sure. So there's a sensitivity that's there now that I think is perpetuated by the media. We need to do something about that. We need to change, the narrative, the story about, local schools, about school systems, and it has to become, something other than an us and them type of thing. But I think that's true of politics in general. You know, any political, public institution, I think, is going through the same sort of crisis.
Yeah, I think it's a genuine problem. I agree. I think, you know, it's hard. You know, I don't even know really where to say. Like, it's such a struggle. I just don't know how to, I don't know how we address it. I mean, not to be glib, but I think Voice Ed is doing that, right? I think Voice Ed is putting those voices out there in a very real and honest way. You know, and I think that's one way we combat that problem is by getting the truth out there, as it were, you know, the honest impressions of what education is really like. And I think that's one way we accomplish that goal. And the other is by doing what you're doing and reaching out to the local, you know, media people that are dealing with the education beat. So I think that's something, but it is a real struggle.
And I think it will continue to be a struggle. And I think it's the time we live in. I think social media has made everyone's life a little more transparent. You know, politicians, teachers, things that used to be private are, sometimes of our own volition made public. And, I think we're paying the price and we're going to have to come through it, and we're going to have to find a way, to come through it, and maintain our sense of humanity and our sense of sanity in all of this. We still need people to come into the profession. And I think any, you know, the Me Too movement, has proven that, anyone in the public eye is fair game. And again, I don't want to put a negative spin on it there. But I think there's a little bit of caution on everyone's part now. And, I think that's sad, but I think it's important to talk about and to recognize.
Yeah. And I mean, there is an argument to be made that caution isn't bad either. You know, I mean, if teachers were never doing anything wrong, there wouldn't be anything negative to report. I mean, we're far from a group of perfect people, you know? So, I mean, I think there is something to be said there that transparency, while frustrating to some of us, is probably good for most in the long run.
Well, I think accountability comes from transparency. And certainly I'm not saying let's hide everything, in our classrooms. I mean, opening up our classrooms. But it's an interesting time. It's an interesting time to be in education. It's an interesting time to be alive. If you venture out into social media, as Rafi Kevukian, says in his book, Light Web, Dark Web, it's, you know, it's, we're drawn to it, but there's a shadow side to it as well. And I think we need to be aware of that, not to be afraid of it, but just to be aware of it. And I think it's interesting, yeah. You know, it's really, really 100%. Interesting.
I agree. I'm obviously drawn to this medium as well. And the internet is where I spend a lot of my time. So I definitely agree. And it does. It creates a struggle, I think, for everybody. I'm gonna lead into my next question here because I'm curious where you're gonna take this one. I'm not sure where I think you're gonna take this, which is interesting. So my next question for you is, what is something you're doing that you wish everybody would be, all teachers would do, I should say.
To me, it's something that I've started to be aware of the need to do. And something that I'm doing more and more. And that is, I'm going to put air quotes around the phrase, reading outside of my ecosystem. So, and it's more than reading. It's reading, listening, forcing myself into conversations, about things that I know nothing about. And in particular, in the context of education, positions that I don't hold myself. And that has been a game changer for me. So when I referred to those two voices that, have been part of Voice Ed, recently, I've told the story before. I wandered into a, blog space about 12 years ago, that I innocently declared myself as kind of a progressive educator. And it was, I liken it to what it would be like to go into an ocean environment with a cut on your arm. The sharks just swarmed around me, and for a good decade, I kept going back. I kept going back, fascinated by this, and a little bit. It was a little bit sadistic, I guess. But I wanted to know what caused the political right to be politically right, and believe they were right. And I had as much passion for my position as they did for theirs, but I didn't realize it at the time. I just thought they were wrong. And how could you believe this? How could you in a province and in a country that prides itself on its public education system, how could you possibly argue for charter schools or vouchers? And I know that that's something that south of the border, mm-hmm. they talk about a lot, but it's not something we do here. In a couple of discrete examples, I mean, Alberta has a charter school system. But over the years, Brad, I kept at those conversations, and it has opened my eyes so much to just thinking differently, not anchoring myself in my own beliefs all of the time. So I spend the first part of every day that I can, when I'm not filling the stream at Voice Ed Radio with stuff I should have filled the night before, reading magazines and articles and research material that people recommend that I know is going to lead me to challenge and be uncomfortable. And that is something that I think more people need to do. Not because I'm doing it, but because there's a perspective taking there that we need to engage in. And I think that is what how I would answer that question.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm good at that.
I'm not good at it either, but I'm trying.
I am. It is a daily struggle. In fact, we kind of mentioned before we recorded that this is kind of this is related to my own personal struggle recently, which is I often feel like when I go to work every day, I have to put aside the best part of my professional self. And in my eyes, my work on my podcast and the conversations I have in Voice Ed and through Twitter and through other social media and listening to all these great podcasters is that progressive, change-driven part of me. And I have to put a lot of that aside at my day job because we have a lot of veteran teachers who are not on board with that kind of change and disruption. And it's speaking to me in that I struggle to relate to a lot of my teachers sometimes. And I think this would probably help me, right? Like reading more in the space of no, everything's perfect, which I can't even say without feeling sarcastic, is like, I don't know. It's hard to wrap my head around somewhat to their positions.
And again, I'm going to use that word proxy. I think the reading for me is it's a proxy for what I really need to be engaged in. And what I'm trying to be engaged in this space is, conversations, again, hearing people's voice, and not, reacting and not having to put on three layers of antiperspirant before I have the conversation, and learning and listening and not as a patronizing, modeling thing for other people, but just for my own, sense of reality. You know, I didn't realize until 2 months before my father passed away that he was conservative. I didn't know. I mean, we never saw eye to eye on anything. But it was a couple of months before he passed away, which was 2 years ago, that I realized that we did not see eye to eye politically. He was a conservative. I could have sworn he voted liberal, which would have been Democratic, Democrat. So that was amazing. How could you live with someone for all of that time, and not know that about them? And so that for me was a real turning point. I think most people that I know, we assume when we're on social media that, you know, everybody's, vibrantly involved in the conversations, that, the whole world is our world. So it's kind of a skewed view of reality. When you go into your staff, can I tell you a story?
Of course.
Okay. So it's 1993 and, the internet, in whatever form it was just coming into schools here in Canada. And I was part of a nationwide, project called SchoolNet. And there were 300 schools across Canada that were given, internet access through a university. And we were going to explore what all of this meant. I was so excited. It was a 14.4 baud modem that I had. You know, you put in your username and you'd go make a cup of tea or have a shower and come in and put in your password. And it would all be text. There would be no graphics. There was nothing. It took like an hour to download a 28K image, you know, off the internet. And they had gophers and the Minnesota, gopher for weather was, you know, it was exciting. It was really exciting. But I remember, finding a site where people could start to share lesson plans. And, our whole school got on the internet and some people embraced it and some people didn't. And I started posting and receiving some lesson plans on this site. Well, it was a Friday afternoon and, it was a Friday morning. And, one of my colleagues came running down the hall with this lesson plan in her hand. She said, "This is my day. This is so great." And I looked at it and I said, "That's my lesson plan." We hadn't talked all year about lesson plans. We had connected because I had posted something and I guess it was anonymous or the name wasn't attached to it. She had pulled it down and that's what got us into this conversation. And it was kind of funny. And so I think, one of the things that's happened is the our life on, in social media has maybe cushioned the blow of what you're experiencing in that, you may be the only one on your campus that is this enthusiastically involved in these conversations. But back then, I think it was the culture of the school. You didn't have anything like the internet before 1993 to let you know that there were other people out there thinking about these things. So I think it's a reality. I was told by someone, by a principal once, because I used to get excited about everything. I used to get excited about, and I still do. He said, you know, Hurley, if you put your head too far above the crowd, someone's going to shoot it off. He said, those were his words. So he said, calm down. Just keep your head down. You know, you've only got 20 years left. I don't know if that cycles back to what we were originally talking about, but
I think it does, or it doesn't, and it's my show. Who cares? I said, you know, it's whatever. I think it does. No, I think you're right. I think, you know, it is easy to feel that frustration, because I think you're right. I would either feel even more isolated at my school if it weren't for the power of the internet than I do now, or I wouldn't even know that all these progressive, interesting ideas are out there, because I would only know what all the other teachers in my school are doing. So I think you're right. The problem is created because of the good thing.
Yeah, you're right. And I remember calling a professor I had in my Faculty of Education, School of Education year. I called him at the 10-year point in my, at the 10-year point in my career. I actually took a leave of absence and went and lived with a religious community for 6 months. And then 5 years after that, I called this professor and, no, that's wrong too. Let me get this straight. It's a religious community. 5 years later, I called my philosophy professor at the university and I said, I think I'm going to leave teaching and go back and do my PhD in philosophy, because he indicated when we were together, you know, in my undergrad that I might have a future in philosophy. But then 2 years after that, I got really restless and my faculty of education professor said, come down and do your master's. Come down and do your master's. And what he was saying to me is, come down and meet people who think like you do, or think kind of like you do. And that was the best advice. I actually enrolled in a master's program. I actually took a job at the university, the Faculty of Education here in Toronto, for 3 years. It was a secondment. Did my master's at the same time, and I was absolutely in heaven. And then, after leaving that, so I'd been teaching at a Faculty of Education for 3 years, had my master's. My school board had told me before I left, the personnel manager said, come back prepared to do what you want to do. I came back. I said to him, I'm prepared to do what I want to do. It's teacher development. I have my master's in teacher development from OISE. They put me in a grade 8 classroom in a small school in a community of teachers that didn't seem to care about anything. And that's where I was placed. And I died. I did. I was going to quit. It was just so pathetic. The work that I had done while I was away wasn't recognized, but that they, I was placed in this community. I mean, people had been there for years. They were nice people, but I didn't have the conversations that I was having in the previous 3 years when I was doing that master's program. So have you done your master's?
No. Nope.
Have you gone back and okay.
Definitely not.
You're going to meet those people, and you're going to meet them face to face. You're going to meet them face to face. Here's Uncle Stephen giving Brad some advice.
Yeah, no, I'm not planning on doing my master's ever. It's not really the plan.
Well, it's not the master's, you know, it's digging into something that you care. And you're doing that. I mean, you're the master of podcasting. I mean, it's an MPA or whatever, you know, you put that on your credentials.
Yeah. I'll throw that right on there. That works. from the University of Voice Ed in Canada. That's what it'll be.
Oh, yes. Micro-credential. I'll offer it to you.
Ah, oh, man, such a good conversation, Stephen. You got like great stories. You know, you are like the voice on Voice Ed. You just pop in from time to time, but you don't always like, I don't know. You don't always share your stories. I don't feel like I'm hearing stories I don't normally hear from you. You know, I get bits and pieces, and then you step out of the way again to let other people talk. So I'm enjoying having this opportunity to hear from you a little more.
Can I tell you a story about that?
Absolutely.
My dad, who I never, I mean, we, our Sunday dinners, at our home, and we had five kids in the family. They were brutal, around the dinner table, you know, because we would argue about everything. And when I went into public education, I remember my dad saying when I came home from my first year of teaching, he says, "So what do you, where are you working for the summer?" And I said, "What?" And so that got me onto the path of, I spent most of my summers after then, in the school. As soon as I could get in there, I went in there just to prove to him that I was actually doing something for the summer. And, so I remember after years, and the whole family, my extended family, a very large extended family, knew this about Dad and I. He used to bait me. He used to, try to get me talking about teacher unions, the work of the teacher and so I remember, about 15 years ago, there was a family gathering, and my parents have a pool in their backyard, and everybody was gathered around. It was August. We were eating corn and grilling steak on the barbecue. And my dad, got into one of these political conversations, and I was very quiet. I learned to be very quiet. And, so we're sitting around the pool, and I'm listening to him try to bait people. And, he looked at me. And these, my aunts and uncles around the table, there are about 12 of them. And he said, "Well, Stephen, what about you? Don't you have an opinion?" And I looked at him and I said, "Oh, I have an opinion. I'm just not used to being asked." And the whole yard just broke up, and people still tell that story, still tell that story. So I know my stories are welcome here, but I prefer to kind of stay in the background. I guess the childhood experiences of not being asked kind of get into your DNA, and it's not a false sense of humility. It's probably a psychological, a traumatic thing that I need to go and get some therapy for.
Probably. You should probably look into that.
I will.
Well, you know, you're talking a lot about stories and talking about your past, so I got to ask my last question, which is, who is the best teacher you have ever had?
I've heard you ask that question before, and people really, there's a mixed set of responses. The best teacher I've ever had, I have to say, was Gene Way. And he was my grade 8 teacher. And he wasn't my best teacher for what he taught me, because I really struggled during that year. I took 3 weeks off of school, because I was afraid of my own shadow in grade 8. I was afraid that I was being, teased. We didn't call it bullying then, but I there was something happening there. I had discovered, things about myself as a young man growing up, and it was just a tough time for me. Not things that, you know, would be traumatic but I've just, you know, had feelings. I fell in love and got jilted and teased about that. And, anyway, so that great, but Gene Way stepped into that fray, and he seemed to understand. He seemed to be able to say, you know what, you're you. And he didn't make a big thing of it, but what he did was he gave me a job. He gave me a job. I was his media guy. So, every Friday, he had just come back from a sabbatical, and he went around the world with his wife, and he took a lot of pictures. He took a lot of slides. Back then they had those Kodak carousels of slides that you would show. And he, wanted to allow us, to experience some of what he experienced. So I was the guy who got to set up the 16mm film projector. I was the guy who got to set up the slide carousel. I was the guy who, every week would fill out the order form for the films from the district office that would arrive in the courier 2 days later. When my parents went for our first term interview, we weren't allowed. We had to wait until they got home to find out how we were doing. You remember that? And, my dad looked at me and he said, well, that was interesting. And my mom said, Mr. Way said that you are his right-hand man. I'd never been anyone's right-hand man before. And he gave me a job, and it was a job in media, and it was a job that nobody else had. And so it became kind of an identity thing for me. I discovered something about myself because of that. He had no intention of doing that. He just wanted someone that was interested in filling out the forms and setting up the film projector. But you know, you've experienced this in the work that you do. You can identify those kids that are so motivated by your sense of trust in them that they shine. And I don't know if I shone in grade 8. I don't know if I shone in grade 9 or 10, but several years later, when I went into teaching, I was on a retreat just before the Christmas season. And again, it was a Catholic school board, so we had these Advent retreats in secluded spots. I was doing some music, and people around the room were invited to reflect on a student that they had that day or that week, or, you know, in their careers that made an impact on them. Gene Way was in the room. And who do you think he pointed to? Who do you think he spoke about? Spoke about me. And that was like 30 years later. And wow, talk about closing a circle. So I point to him, and I honor him and give him a shout out because he's still around. And he came back from that sabbatical, and he did not want to be there. He really was kind of struggling, but he made such an impact on me just because he saw something in me that maybe I didn't see in myself, and he let me go.
That's a really great story to just like, wow. Like I'm like speechless. I'm trying to like, I almost got chills with the whole end part there. Like you got me, man. You got me.
Well, it's, I've never told that story before. I've never told that story before. It's like my dad said, well, I've never been asked really. I've asked other people, but, yeah. So that's it, but it just stands out so clearly. And isn't it interesting when you ask people about that memorable teacher comes to mind very quickly. But how many teachers have we had, and that that go in and do their job, some of them better than others, but there's always one that sort of rises to the top, and it's usually not because they taught you, how to decline Latin verb or how to recite the Pythagorean theorem, something else, something very human. And that takes us back to that that first question, where I believe that we need to rediscover the humanity of what we're doing as educators, as systems of education.
Well, you tied that vein in perfectly for me, so I don't have to do it now. You're exactly right. It's that human component. And in 40 something episodes of this show at this point, almost a year of my own show now, no one has said, oh, this teacher, because I learned so much about subject. It's never that. That's mm-hmm. never the thing we remember teachers for. And, the origin of that question comes from Kristen Iannuzzi in her teacher story, where she says, ask anybody in the world who their favorite teacher is, and they'll tell you a story. And the power of stories has never been lost on me, is something I believe in wholeheartedly. And that moment always spoke to me. And the story is never, I could not figure out my multiplications tables, and then this teacher came along, and now I know how to multiply in my head. Like, it's never that, right? It's always that real moment. It's never something that the data is going to show us. It's never something that, okay, what's the problem is going to answer. It's those moments of human connection that it takes a really special person to have, with undeveloped, immature children sometimes. And I think that's what is the challenge of this field, right?
It is the challenge of this field. And, going back to that whole conversation about positive psychology, I spent a few weeks sitting at the feet of David Cooperrider studying appreciative inquiry. And appreciative inquiry it's a wonderful set of conversations to have that begins with the invitation. Tell me a story of when you felt you were at your best. And I ask that in the work that I do with educators and with parents and even politicians across Canada have used that. Tell me a story of when you have felt at your best in the work that you do. And Brad, it is amazing. It is amazing. And you say, okay, pair up and go off and tell that story. I had a session a few years back in Newfoundland, which is a great place to go and just meet people, and they have a whole sense of party that we wouldn't even understand. I made the mistake of saying, go anywhere and tell that story to someone. I had to go to the local pub to find half of the group, actually. but the invitation, you know, and how often in our staff meetings and how often in our district offices do we extend that invitation? Tell me a story of when you felt you were at your best. And then let's look at that story and let's look at the conditions that allowed that story to take flight. And what if those conditions existed more often for more people? It's a way of storytelling that is so powerful. It's so positive. But it elicits a lot of neat stuff.
You know, I'm good with living it there, though. I'm good. That's a very positive, uplifting moment. I'm going to go with that and say, you know, I hope my audience goes out and tells somebody the story of when they were at their best. I think that's a great thing to think about, that positive psychology.
And then let's collect those stories on Voice Ed Radio.
Always, always.
Well, I appreciate this time. I know I'm not the host, but I have to say thank you. Thank you for having me on. I'm glad I waited this long. And I just want to, you know, thank you for the work that you're doing in this space. And I remember that summer day I was up at a cottage for a couple of weeks. When you decided that you were going to go live with, I think it was Ashley McBride.
I mean, it technically wasn't with Ashley McBride. It was me talking to myself for 5 minutes. But yeah, you know.
Yeah, I remember that. And I remember logging on to the station and I was so nervous about leaving. I don't know why. But I heard your voice and I thought, man, there's something happening here. There is something happening here. And that was, you know, you took that risk. To go live, and you know, you fast forward a number of weeks, and last Thursday you took a risk to go live with something that mattered to you, and you're really helping to create a real powerful community here. And Brad, I appreciate that. And my dying wish, you know, it's not my dying wish, but a dying wish of this podcast is to encourage my fellow Voice Ed Radio community members to put a R.
You know, I caught that on with you talking to Derek last week. I was cracking up. I was like, I'm used to people butchering my name, but I was like, Steven with the correction. Nicely done. Nicely done. You Canadians don't get a lot of German names in your life, I guess.
Oh, is it German? Well, I think it's just it's Schreff.
It's a very ugly sound. Let's be honest.
But pay attention, people. I mean, it's his name. Come on.
Steven, I appreciate that. I really do. I appreciate, you know, I appreciate everything you do on Voice Ed, but you are always encouraging and I appreciate that. And I genuinely appreciate you being on the show. All joking aside, it has been hard to schedule and my life has been chaotic and you're making things happen at Voice Ed. And so I understand that. And I really appreciate you sitting with me. I think this has been an awesome conversation. I can't wait to get this out there for people to hear it. It's going to be awesome. And I'm sure I will get it to you like at least an hour before it's supposed to go live on Voice Ed, which is what I typically do.
I love that.
So thanks. I really appreciate it. How can people get a hold of you if they want to talk to you, Steven?
No, I don't have time. No, it's, Steven_, it's Steven with a PH. Thanks, Mom. Steven with a PH _ Hurley, HURLEY. And, that's my Twitter handle, or at voiceed.ca. I used to give out my website address, like my personal one, but I paid a lot of money for that website And I haven't been on there in over a year. I have to go and see if it's still standing. But yeah, no, Stephen_Hurley. That's Twitter is probably the best way to get me. Here at voiceed.ca.
And I always encourage my audience to go to voiceed.ca and listen to the stuff that's going on there, because it is really an awesome space. If you like what I'm doing on the podcast, you will love the stuff going on at VoiceEd for sure.
Oh, it's cool. It is very cool.
All right, Stephen, I really appreciate it, man. Have a great night.
Thanks, Brad.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining me. I really do appreciate it and finally being with me on the podcast. As much as I give you a hard time, I know it wasn't you avoiding me, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. If you want to connect with Stephen, you can find him on Twitter. He's at Stephen_Hurley. And of course, you can always find him on VoiceEd Radio, which you can listen to on TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, or over at voiceed.ca. All of those links are in the show notes. As you know, I love the work that network is doing and highly encourage my listeners to go over and join the education party that's happening there. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always find me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Also, in the last couple weeks, I started an Instagram page for myself and the show as well, which is also Brad Schreffler on Instagram. So go over and give that a follow. I'm just starting to build it up. I'm trying to build some videos and more visual content to put on there. It is not just pictures of the logo and then links. It is more stuff than that. So check out the Instagram page if you're on Instagram, Brad Schreffler over there as well. Until next week, go out and tell someone the story of when you were at your best. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.